Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Extreme conditions. 100 deaths in Western Canada are believed to have been caused by a record-breaking heat wave. Then, an uncertain future. The top U.S. commander in Afghanistan warns the country could descend into civil war following the departure of American troops. Plus, a dramatic turnaround. Bill Cosby is released from prison after his sexual assault conviction is overturned. And coming back from COVID, many school districts intensify their summer programs to make up for the learning loss during the pandemic.
Typically, in a 9.5-month school year, our kids made 9.5 months of growth or more. What we saw during the pandemic was that they made 5.3 months in literacy and 7.2 months in math.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Parts of Washington State, Oregon, and Idaho spent another day baking in sweltering temperatures. Rolling blackouts continue in the city of Spokane, Washington, which hit a record 109 degrees yesterday. President Biden lamented the brutal heat during a virtual meeting with the governors of Western states.
The extreme heat we're seeing in the West is not only a risk amplifier for wildfires, it's a threat in and of itself. People are hurting. It's more dangerous for kids to play outside. Roads are buckling under the heat. I need not tell all of you.
Meantime, a dangerous heat wave in Canada is slowly starting to ease. It scorched the Pacific Coast province of British Columbia, with temperatures 30 to 40 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than normal. One city recorded a reading of 122. The plains of Alberta and Manitoba provinces have also been blasted. At least 233 people died in British Columbia between Friday and Monday alone. That is about 100 more than the normal four-day average. Joining me now to discuss this is David Phillips. He's senior climatologist at Environment Canada. It's the Canadian government department responsible for environmental policy. Mr. Phillips, thank you so much for joining us. Tell us, what is Canada dealing with right now?
Well, Judy, it's unprecedented. Historically, we've never seen this before. The last warm temperature that we've always talked about in Canada was back in Yellowgrass, Saskatchewan, back 84 years ago. And we have seen this week just 400 records have been broken in the West. And that's just the warm temperatures during the day. And these are just not a tenth of a degree warmer than the previous record. We are seeing just, it's like a different world for us here. We are the second coldest country in the world and the snowiest. And we are dealing with something that we're not used to. And it's so extreme, it's long lasting. And as you mentioned, it's beginning to have health effects, environmental effects, and certainly economic effects.
And what do you know about the science that's behind this heat wave? What is causing this? And of course, everybody wants to understand, is it connected to climate change?
Well, you know, Judy, it is really a dome. It's like putting a dome stadium over an area from the Arctic Circle down to California. And what happens in that dome is the air gets trapped. It can't leave. It gets progressively warmer. It squeezes down and it just gets hotter and hotter. And no weather can get in the way. And of course, we often say, well, every time we see an extreme event, we say, well, is this climate change? And I think we've hidden enough behind the fact that we say, well, climate change doesn't create weather. It doesn't create heat waves and forest fires and hurricanes. But Judy, what it does is it contributes to it. There are many factors that create extreme weather, and the physical factors, but now we're realizing that there's human factors. And this heat wave would not have been as nearly as brutal and deadly if it hadn't been for what's coming out of our tailpipes and smokestacks.
Who is most affected?
Judy, it's the elderly, of course. It's infants who don't have the sweat glands. It's outdoor workers. It's the homeless. It is people with you know, with health-related illnesses. And that's why we're seeing so many deaths, but a lot more emergency entrances. And, you know, we still have lockdown situations in Canada. And so breathing through a mask and these kind of temperatures is just, you know, just brutal. And it people don't go outside. People are moving from their homes to hotels because they don't have air conditioning. I mean, there's only less than half the people in Western Canada have air conditioning. So it's something that we've never dealt with before, and we're trying to cope with it. And the only good news is that maybe in 5 or 6 days, it will be history. But boy, it will take its toll before we get there.
It sounds as if you're saying the government and the people of Canada were just not prepared for this.
Well, it was well forecast, Judy, but it's just so fundamentally different. It's like rewriting the climate of Canada to have to deal with this. And so you don't want to overdesign and underdesign. You sort of want to match the existing conditions. But this is really a dress rehearsal, almost the opening act of what we're going to see more of. I hope we learn from it to say, hey, this occurred once. It could occur again, and it won't be 83 years before we break another record. So I think we need to prepare for it.
You do expect this kind of climate, this kind of weather to return in the future.
Absolutely, Judy. You know, weather repeats itself. And so if you get this, if it's physically possible to get this, it could only ramp up that much more and more frequently. So I think this is a kind of a lesson from nature. It's giving us a heads up, and hopefully we're smart enough to pay attention to it.
David Phillips, environmentalist with the Canadian government, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Judy.
Back in the U.S., the medical examiner of Multnomah County reports that 45 deaths were due to extreme heat since Friday. In the day's other news, search teams recovered four more bodies from a collapsed condominium tower in Surfside, Florida. With the search in its seventh day, the number of confirmed dead reached 16, with more than 140 still missing. But officials insisted they aren't giving up hope.
Well, there's been some talk by the families. They've asked me if the search is going to stop. You know, are we going to turn this from a rescue to a recovery? And I appreciated the governor's comments just a few minutes ago, where he basically said, we're not leaving anybody behind. This is going to go until we pull everybody out of there. This is our number one effort.
Officials said they're also watching a pair of potential tropical storms in the Atlantic Ocean that could hit South Florida in the days ahead. An indigenous group in Canada reports finding another 182 sets of human remains near a former school in British Columbia. The school for Indian children near Cranbrook was operated by the Catholic Church until the early 1970s. Hundreds of other unmarked graves have been found at two similar sites in Canada. Back in this country, actor Bill Cosby was released from prison in Pennsylvania after the state Supreme Court overturned his sexual assault conviction. He arrived home in suburban Philadelphia hours later, having served nearly 3 years of a 3 to 10 year sentence. We'll take a closer look later in the program. There is word tonight that former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, who championed the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, has died. His family says he passed away Tuesday in Taos, New Mexico. Nick Schifrin reports on his life and legacy.
A Navy veteran and Republican congressman from Illinois, Donald Rumsfeld was America's youngest defense secretary during the Cold War. He was also its oldest defense secretary and oversaw the wars post 9/11 and served amid deep and lasting controversy. On the morning of September 11th, he was a stretcher bearer ferrying wounded from the Pentagon.
The fact is, in this battle against terrorism, there is no silver bullet.
He was an architect of both the Afghanistan and Iraq wars under President George W. Bush, and he propagated the now debunked argument that Saddam Hussein harbored weapons of mass destruction.
What do you make of the statement made by the Iraqi government, yesterday that Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction and is not developing any?
They're lying. Next.
Rumsfeld was also a key proponent of the U.S.'s use of what he called enhanced interrogation. Others call it torture, including at Baghdad's Abu Ghraib prison. The wars continued and casualties climbed, but Rumsfeld dismissed complaints from troops that they were ill-prepared.
As you know, you go to war with the army you have, not the army you might want or wish to have at a later time.
Shortly after the 2006 midterms, then-President Bush fired Rumsfeld. Today, Mr. Bush called him a man of intelligence, integrity, and almost inexhaustible energy, who never paled before tough decisions and never flinched from responsibility. Donald Rumsfeld was 88 years old. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
And on the pandemic, the head of the CDC, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, said today that mask guidelines will be left to local officials. That's after Los Angeles County urged a return to wearing masks at indoor public spaces as the Delta variant spreads. Meanwhile, North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, blamed the country's senior officials for what he called a, quote, great crisis. North Korea previously claimed to have no infections. The U.S. House of Representatives voted today to create a select committee to investigate the January assault on the U.S. Capitol. It will include 13 members, mostly Democrats. All but two Republicans opposed the action, and they traded jibes with Democrats over which side is being more partisan.
Most fundamental to any objective investigation is being free from political influence and partisan bias. Unfortunately, this resolution fails to meet that basic benchmark.
Come on, give me a break. I mean, we had a bipartisan commission, equally divided, equal subpoena power. They voted against it. The minority leader of this House whipped against it and fought against it and convinced the Senate to try to kill it.
There is no deadline for when the select committee is to make its report. Former President Trump spent this day at the U.S.-Mexico border as he makes his return to public view. He toured a section of unfinished border wall outside Weslaco, Texas, and attacked President Biden for rescinding his policies on migrants. The appearance came as prosecutors in New York are expected tomorrow to charge the Trump Organization with tax-related crimes. In Myanmar, the military government began releasing some 2,300 prisoners. They include demonstrators who protested against the military coup last February and some journalists. The government says those released did not take part in any violence. There is no word on how many others might remain behind bars. And on Wall Street, stocks mostly moved higher in quiet trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 210 points to close at 34,502. The Nasdaq fell 24 points, and the S&P 500 added 5 points for another record close. Still to come on the NewsHour, chaotic ballot counting leaves the results of the New York City mayor's race in question. College athletes gain the power to receive compensation for their likenesses. Many school districts intensify summer programs to combat learning loss during the pandemic, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The U.S. is on the verge of completing a unilateral and unconditional withdrawal from Afghanistan, nearly 20 years after it invaded. And the outgoing U.S. military commander has delivered a new stark warning about the future of the country. Nick Schifrin is back right now, and he joins me. Nick, good to have you with us to talk about this as well. What are the military leaders saying they believe can happen?
Yeah, this is perhaps as blunt and pessimistic a statement as the military has ever made about Afghanistan. It's also the first time that the Biden administration or the military has publicly acknowledged the ultimate risk of this withdrawal. This is General Scott Miller, the U.S. commander in Kabul, telling journalists civil war is certainly a path that can be visualized. If this continues on the trajectory it's on right now, that should be a concern to the world, and it's certainly a concern to the region for creating an environment where there's even more violence than there is today. So what's behind this warning? The first thing, Taliban strength. Since the U.S. announced its withdrawal, the Taliban have seized some 50 districts around the country, some of them not so important, but others critical, and could cut off Kabul from the other parts of the country. Second, Afghan army weakness. Across the country, we are seeing examples of the Afghan army surrendering to the Taliban. That's what you're seeing right there, surrendering to the Taliban instead of fighting. The speed with which they have given up territory has surprised the U.S. and the Afghan governments. And third, ethnic and government divisions. These are civilians recreating local militias, and that harkens back to a time in Afghanistan where the country was ruled or not ruled because there were so many local militias overseen by warlords. So it's pretty grim. Judy, there's an intelligence community assessment that Kabul could fall within 6 months, but there are also assessments that Kabul could hold on even if it loses other parts of the country. But the bottom line, the U.S. will not be there to save the Afghan military or the Afghan government.
Pretty ominous. And Nick, given this, is that affecting the timetable for U.S. troop withdrawal?
In a short answer, no. The Afghan government asked the U.S. to delay the withdrawal, but the withdrawal, other than the airport and the embassy, is imminent. Take a look at this video from Bagram Air Base outside of Kabul. These are hundreds of service members leaving Bagram. This is really the heart of the U.S. effort in central Afghanistan. This is the symbol of the withdrawal, imminent. Moving over to the Afghans. But there are details outstanding of the withdrawal. Firstly, contractors who service Afghan helicopters right now are also leaving. So the administration is trying to figure out where to do that servicing outside of Afghanistan. The airport. Turkey's agreeing to protect the airport you see right there, but Turkey's asking for U.S. service members to stay there and also asking for NATO reimbursement. So those discussions are ongoing. And lastly, the embassy. Hundreds of service members will stay to guard the giant embassy compound in the heart of Kabul. You see it there. This is critical. The U.S. says it needs U.S. troops to secure that embassy. It needs an embassy to continue to support Afghanistan in the future. But the Taliban reject that. The Taliban have never said that they would allow U.S. troops to stay there. And so a senior military official tells me today, if the Taliban attack the embassy, they'll have to evaluate whether they can keep it open. Other officials admit to me they do not know whether the embassy is sustainable.
And finally, and just quickly, Nick, a lot of concern about the interpreters and other Afghan citizens who have been helping the U.S. over the last 20 years.
Yeah, 17,000 interpreters, tens of thousands of their family members have applied for special immigrant visas. For some of them, this is life and death. Some 300 of them have been killed since 2014. The plan is to evacuate them to a U.S. territory, not to a third country. The administration is still working out specifics, but the military says they're ready and able to do that at any point, so long as the U.S. and Turkey can figure out how to secure that airport. And so at this point, the administration emphasizes the billions of dollars of continuing support, the ongoing training, and highlights that there are no U.S. casualties right now and won't be. But the senior Afghan officials I talked to say that their country is being abandoned, and they are very, very worried about the future of Afghanistan.
No, and no wonder. Yeah. Nick Schifrin, thank you.
Thank you.
It has been more than a week since the polls closed in New York City. The Board of Elections just released updated tallies, but there is still no call on the Democratic primary results for mayor. One cause for the wait, a new system of voting called ranked choice, which lets voters list up to five candidates on their ballot. But the counting took a confusing turn yesterday. Yamiche Alcindor reports.
For the New York City Board of Elections, it's been a chaotic 24 hours. Yesterday, on their results webpage, the city posted some unofficial results, including 135,000 new ballots. Those results showed that the lead of the current frontrunner, Eric Adams, had significantly narrowed against his two closest competitors, Maya Wiley and Catherine Garcia. But hours later, the city removed those additional ballots. Officials said a software error included sample test votes in the official tally. Here to help us understand what went wrong and what it means for ranked choice voting, I'm joined by Christina Greer. She is a professor of political science at Fordham University. Christina, thank you so much for being here. What in the world is going on? Why all of this confusion?
So New York City voters decided that we were going to use ranked choice voting for our municipal elections. And this is a period where instead of having the winner take all and the winner of the election getting 40% or more and being declared the victor, this is a system that essentially counts all ballots. Eric Adams, as you mentioned, is in the lead, but we still have absentee and affidavit ballots that need to be counted. And until all of those ballots are counted, we do not know who the mayor of New York City will be. It will most likely be another week or two because those absentee ballots have to be postmarked by June 22nd, but they still can come in up until a week later. And so the Board of Elections is just now starting to count over 100,000 absentee ballots that aren't even in the tally that we had on election night.
Mm. And why did New York City, the largest city in the United States, why did it implement ranked choice voting? And what are the benefits supposed to be?
Well, the benefits are supposed to be, when we looked at places like Minneapolis or San Francisco, to include candidates of color, female candidates of color, to give them a better opportunity. Because ostensibly, if you can vote up until up to five people, mm-hmm. You possibly don't have to think strategically in the way that a lot of people do. And so we know that in past elections, people might say, well, I really like this candidate, but because she's a woman, she has no chance of winning. So I'll vote for my second or third choice. This gives voters the opportunity to say, well, I really do like this particular candidate, and I'm going to rank them first. And you don't have to be as sort of strategic as people have been in the past. Now, it's a little complicated because some people are still strategic with their ballots. Others who are critics of the system complain that there wasn't enough education to really explain whether or not you should just vote for your ideal candidate, mm-hmm. whether or not you should vote for up to all five or just choose three. And part of the confusion is that the Board of Elections didn't really want to put out too much literature explaining this process during 2020 because they didn't want to confuse voters because we did not use ranked choice voting in November of 2020 for the presidential election.
And Eric Adams, the front runner right now, he has filed a lawsuit. What's that going to mean for what happens next and how, and whether or not, I should say, New Yorkers really ultimately trust these results?
Right. So filing lawsuits isn't terribly uncommon. Andrew Yang filed a lawsuit well before the election was over, and he came in fourth as of now. Eric Adams, though, is not part of the political class, even though he's been a public servant for quite some time. He has an insider-outsider type status. And so his concern is that, you know, those in power don't necessarily want him to be the 110th mayor of New York. I think the concern for people like me is that the longer it takes to count the ballots, obviously confidence in the system erodes from some voters who think that, you know, there could be discrepancies or some sort of inconsistencies or corruption. But we're trying to explain to New York City voters with this complex system, we are a city of almost 9 million people, even though our turnout is pretty low, it's about 25% of the voting eligible population, it's more important to get it right than to get it fast.
How do you see this issue in New York City connecting with the larger conversation we're having nationally when it comes to the false claims of voter fraud, these GOP-backed laws restricting voting?
Well, I mean, sometimes there's incompetence and sometimes there's fraud. I think right now we're looking at incompetence and a real restructuring of the Board of Elections in New York City needs to happen. And those are conversations that need to extend well beyond Election Day. Sadly, though, the two have been conflated and we'll have to have some real conversations, especially depending on who is victorious whenever we get these ballots. It depends on whether or not their opponents actually raise claims of fraud or just inconsistencies.
Mm-hmm. Incompetence, not fraud. We'll keep that going and keep that in mind. Thank you so much, Christina Greer of Fordham University.
Thanks, Yamiche.
The decision by the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court to overturn the sexual assault conviction of Bill Cosby stunned many today. The court said that Cosby's due process rights were violated when he was charged in 2015 for a 2004 assault. During an earlier civil trial involving Cosby and one of his accusers, a prosecutor had said that any statements Cosby made in that trial could not be used against him in a later criminal case, but they were. Today's reversal was a high-profile blow to a conviction in the Me Too era. Nima Ramani is a trial attorney in Los Angeles and a former federal prosecutor. Mr. Ramani, this is, as we said, taken a lot of people by surprise. In a nutshell, what did the court decide?
Judy, you said it. Stunning. I think we were all surprised when the Supreme Court, Pennsylvania Supreme Court, issued its opinion today. We thought that there might be an issue with the prior bad acts witnesses. That was something that they focused on during oral argument and an issue that was litigated at both the trial and appellate court. Those were the other victims that testified, particularly in Bill Cosby's second trial. But they went in a very different direction, and they focused on these statements made during a civil deposition. And not only did the court go so far as to exclude these statements in violation of Bill Cosby's Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, they essentially said that Bruce Castor, the former district attorney, gave Bill Cosby a deal, and they enforced this agreement that would preclude subsequent district attorneys, including Judge Furman and District Attorney Steele, from actually prosecuting Bill Cosby. So this was unprecedented, unexpected, and frankly, unheard of.
And we should say Mr. Castor was one of the attorneys representing former President Trump in his trial before the United States Senate after impeachment. But I want to ask you, you mentioned this is unprecedented. So if, as the state Supreme Court looked at this, what was it that they said the court in making the original decision that sent Mr. Cosby to prison had overlooked? What didn't happen here that was supposed to happen?
Well, what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court did is they construed one of Castor's press releases, which he signed, to be some sort of agreement. So normally as a prosecutor, if you want to get past someone's Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, usually you offer them immunity. Then the privilege goes away because there's no risk of criminal prosecution. Or you can do a non-prosecution agreement. That's what Alex Acosta famously gave Jeff Epstein in Miami. But, you know, a decision not to prosecute, that's something that prosecutors do every single day. And to issue a statement to the press in a high-profile investigation like Bill Cosby, that's something that's routine. So what the Supreme Court did there in Pennsylvania is to say that that was actually an agreement, which was shocking because normally an agreement requires a criminal defendant to give something up. And Bill Cosby really gave nothing up here aside from testimony in a civil case.
Is there recourse, Mr. Romani, for the prosecution in any way here?
There really isn't, at least stateside, Judy. The doors are closed. Had the Pennsylvania Supreme Court simply suppressed the evidence, those damaging statements about drug use and sexual activity that Bill Cosby made in the civil deposition, then the district attorney's office could go back and retry the case. But since they took it so far and said that there's actually an agreement not to prosecute, state prosecutors have their hands tied. They cannot go after Bill Cosby anymore. Now, there's a small window of possibility that the federal government, the Department of Justice, could charge Bill Cosby. I think it's very unlikely. They rarely get involved in these types of state rape cases, but that's a possibility, though very unlikely.
And just quickly and finally, this is taking place, as we say, in the Me Too era when those who have committed either sexual assault or sexual harassment are to be held accountable more than ever. Is this going to affect the movement in that direction? Is this providing some sort of, do you believe it will provide some sort of chilling effect?
Judy, absolutely. This is a huge blow and a setback for the Me Too movement. We know as prosecutors that sexual assault is by far and away the most underreported crime in this country. Victims are hesitant to come forward. When they do, prosecutors don't take these cases, even though they're righteous cases, because they're afraid of losing and because of proof issues. Now you have these victims who've testified not only once, but twice at very public criminal trials to see their abuser walk free, not because he's factually innocent, but because of a constitutional technicality and an agreement made by a district attorney who's no longer in office. It's very disheartening, and my heart goes out to these victims. They've been through so much.
Attorney and former federal prosecutor Nima Romani, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Judy.
It is a game changer for college sports. After years of pressure in and out of court, the NCAA moves to allow college athletes to make money. John Yang helps explain.
Judy, beginning tomorrow, college athletes across the country will be able to make financial deals that capitalize on their celebrity, what's called name, image, and likeness. Even before today's NCAA vote, Iowa basketball player Jordan Bohannon introduced an apparel line, and Wisconsin quarterback Graham Mertz unveiled a trademarked logo. It's a big departure for the NCAA's long-held stance that student-athletes should only get scholarships and stipends. Kevin Blackistone is an ESPN panelist, journalism professor at the University of Maryland, and a sports commentator for the Washington Post. Kevin, thanks for being with us. Name, image, likeness. What exactly does that mean? What are athletes going to be able to do starting tomorrow?
Well, they'll basically be able to do what colleges have been doing with them for eons, and that is take their name, their fame, their jersey numbers, their nicknames, and turn them into some dollar bills to stick in their back pocket. It is a major step, but it is also a step that I think the NCAA has been pushed to do by so much litigation that it's lost in court. By the pressure that's being brought upon it by not only by student athletes, but by a lot of people who represent student athletes.
You write in the Post that you don't think this is enough, the Washington Post. You say that, for one thing, this money isn't coming out of what the college coffers. It's not taking anything away from what they're collecting.
Right, exactly. And that's the thing that, kind of gets me, that I can't take my eyes off. The real problem is that these players, most of whom, by the way, are black males, when you talk about the revenue-generating sports of basketball and football, are generating gazillions of dollars for the NCAA. Well, the NCAA, through this decision, which was pushed by the Supreme Court about a week ago, is still not giving up any of that money to the athletes. Basically, what they're saying is, you know what? You want to earn some money on your own? Then go out there and do it. Just like you and I when we were growing up and we wanted to earn a few bucks by cutting a neighbor's grass. That's basically what they're allowing them to do. And so they're still not getting any workers' comp benefits. They're still not getting long-term health care, which are really the things that they need as college athletes in order to really survive and thrive in this particular game.
The NCAA's argument is that not giving the athletes more money, not giving them anything beyond scholarships, is what distinguishes their product. What do you say to that?
Well, I think it's bogus. Basically, what the NCAA is still doing and what the courts basically allowed them to do, because they really didn't rule on this, is to say that the college game is an amateur game, and that is what is hogwash. Everybody who goes to a college game is either handing over money or making money. Everyone except the athletes who everyone goes to see. And that's really what needs to be fixed. So maybe this is a foot in the door at fixing that problem, but that right now is all it is. And unless and until that gets fixed, I'm hard-pressed as a fan and as a journalist to really celebrate all what has happened in the past week.
As you noted, the NCAA really has been pushed into this. There were state laws about to take effect tomorrow. They wanted to level the playing field, as it were, across the country. Last week, the Supreme Court punched big holes in their amateurism argument. Do you think we're going to see more?
I think that down the line we're going to see more. I think that there will be some more smart lawyers who will be able to bring some more lawsuits against the system that exists. And I think that the fact that now you are basically saying, okay, these athletes really aren't amateurs because they are able to earn some money off of the sport that they play really is going to take the cover off of what's been going on in college sports for a very long time. You know, the funny thing about this is, John, is that the architect of the modern NCAA, Walter Byers, basically wrote a confessional, a memoir back in the mid-1990s called Unsportsmanlike Conduct, Exploitation of the College Athlete. He explained everything that he did with college sports and pointed out the problems with it. And finally now, all these years later, people are coming to grips with it. And these athletes need to be treated like the employees of the industrial complex of higher education and athletics combined that they really are.
Kevin Blackistone, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Summer is clearly here, but the disruptions caused by the pandemic are affecting the summer plans of some students and teachers. Educators around the country are scrambling to help students catch up. Many are utilizing billions in federal stimulus funds to beef up their summer school programs. Stephanie Tsai visited two Atlanta area school districts to see their approach to helping middle schoolers.
All right. Have a good day. I love you.
It's 8 o'clock on a mid-June morning, and instead of enjoying summer break, 12-year-old Christopher Jones is headed to school.
Christopher was an AB student, honor roll student, before the pandemic, and when the pandemic came, his grades dropped B, C, D.
Like other schools, John Lewis Invictus Academy, where Christopher goes, shut its doors in March of 2020. When it reopened earlier this year, 80% of its 950 students chose to stay virtual, but not Christopher. Home was not exactly conducive to learning.
My gosh, it was hard. While I'm on the Zoom, my mom cussing out my brother. My dog's barking, so, you know, my teacher always telling me to mute myself.
I am who I am, not who you think I am.
To address these challenges, educators are now pouring millions of dollars of federal stimulus funds into rigorous summer programs to try and catch kids up, says Atlanta Superintendent Lisa Herring.
The core business of our school system and school systems across the country is teaching and learning. It was disrupted. We have a responsibility to do something immediately for our children.
Who is the main character?
What that means in Atlanta public schools is a full day 9-to-4 summer school that Principal Ramon Garner says homes in on the basics.
The really big difference for this summer academic recovery is that it is focused on math and English, 90 minutes each content area. So this is a total of 3 hours that kids are getting specifically in those content areas.
13.16 plus 5.90.
Watching her son lose ground is what worries Monisha White, a single parent who works the night shift as a lab technician.
With the pandemic, I see a lot of stigmas put on low-income kids that they're not learning.
You don't want him?
No, I don't.
To become a statistic like
No.
Here in Atlanta and across the country, students of color were hit harder by the pandemic than their white counterparts. A McKinsey and Company study found that all students might be 9 months behind in math, but that Black and Hispanic students could be as far as a year behind.
This is a high poverty area. Our school is a Title I school, 100% free and reduced lunch, single parent households. And so home life for some of our students can be very, very challenging.
Lunch, friends, here you go.
The summer program provides food, breakfast, lunch, weekend meals to take home on Fridays, and snacks.
After you put your sugar in there, shake, shake, shake.
Hands-on afternoon sessions, such as the science of ice cream making and flag football, are meant to acclimate students back after a year and a half of social distancing. For many tweens, middle school is fraught with academic and social challenges that the pandemic made harder.
They're growing, they're going through puberty, so their bodies are changing, and oh my gosh, they're very awkward at that age.
A big part of middle school is the social aspect, being able to be in the classroom with students, being able to see your friends, being able to eat lunch every day, things that in the past we've taken for granted.
The amount of learning loss during the pandemic is still difficult to pin down. Standardized tests were canceled last year, then reinstated when many students were still doing virtual learning, making the assessments unreliable.
We know that our kids need us more now after this event than ever before.
But Chief Academic Officer Cliff Jones in Atlanta's Fulton County School District has received some troubling data through a partnership with Georgia State University.
Typically, in a 9.5-month school year, our kids made 9.5 months of growth or more. What we saw during the pandemic was that they made 5.3 months in literacy and 7.2 months in math.
So, Harmony, when you finish,
Would you speckle yours over there?
A rising eighth grader at Sandy Springs Middle School, Harmony Jackson is having to attend summer school for the first time. Before the pandemic forced school online, she regularly got 90s out of 100 on her math tests.
I know it's going to be hard to ask this, but what was your lowest score during the pandemic, during virtual?
It might have been a 50.
How did it feel to get the 50?
It was really shocking because I know I've always been super good at it, and then suddenly you're seeing these low scores and you're like, what happened?
Principal Lori Woodruff wants it to feel like camp. That means literature discussions in an outside courtyard, a scavenger hunt to teach the Pythagorean theorem, and building a roller coaster to demonstrate basic physics.
Oh, I like the two of them. Can I put this down? That's great.
No child wants to be in summer school, right?
Right.
So we've tried to make it a very welcoming place that they want to be here.
Being in the classroom is the best.
Do you feel like you're starting to regain the confidence?
I really am. I'm already starting to get the 90s back that I used to start getting.
That's amazing.
Yes.
To help students like Harmony, Fulton County doubled the number of schools offering summer classes, expanded course options, and opened the program to all students. But finding enough teachers was a challenge, even after $1,000 bonuses were offered.
Our teachers, quite honestly, are exhausted. I could have probably put about 30 more kids in summer school had I had more teachers.
Summer school is just one tool in bringing kids up to grade level. Research shows that more time in the classroom during the regular school year and specialized tutoring programs also help. Both school districts have no illusions that a few weeks in the summer alone can combat the COVID slide.
Our belief is not that everything will be resolved at the end of June 2021.
We know that we have to have a long-term perspective on our plan moving forward. This can't be made up in 1 year.
Both Atlanta Public and Fulton County districts have 3-year plans to get students back up to speed. Summer programs are voluntary, unlike regular school, and registration fell short of district goals, meaning many students will lag behind in the fall. But for some, like Harmony, there are signs of progress.
I'm so happy that the excitement is back on her face. I definitely know without the summer school program, she would not be prepared as a rising eighth grader.
How you feeling today?
When I see the faces get off the school buses every day, I see those kids smiling. And they're coming back every day because, you know, they could very well not come, but they show up.
And now that the pandemic is easing, schools are trying to show up for them. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai in Atlanta.
As the pandemic filled American hospitals and brought life to a near standstill in 2020, the long-standing opioids epidemic was only growing worse, essentially out of sight. As Amna Nawaz reports, the death toll from that epidemic, once centered mainly in rural, largely white parts of the country, appears to have shifted more heavily to urban African-American communities.
Judy, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate that more than 92,000 Americans died of overdoses in the 12 months ending last November. It is the highest number ever recorded and a 30% jump over the prior year. Now, the CDC data is not broken down by race, but researchers at the University of California found the largest increase in overdose deaths was in African Americans, a 50% jump from 2019. In Missouri alone, black men are now 4 times more likely than a white person to die of an overdose. Dr. Kanika Turner is a St. Louis physician whose work centers in neighborhoods hard hit by addiction. She joins us now. Dr. Turner, welcome to the NewsHour, and thank you for being here. Those numbers are just striking. Tell us a little bit, especially over this past pandemic year, what should we understand about them? What's been driving those numbers?
Yeah, I think what's driving those numbers is definitely multifactorial. I think a few things on the streets, with the drug supply changing with the pandemic. So when we went through the shutdown, we saw a significant change in the drug supply. And whenever you see a change in drug supply, that can definitely increase someone's risk for an overdose. So on the streets, we typically saw a lot of fentanyl and fentanyl analogs. With the shutdown across the world, pretty much, we started to see heroin return to streets, where heroin is not as potent as fentanyl. So whenever you have a significant significant change like that, and then people go back to using fentanyl, we then increase someone's risk for an overdose. And I think other things that took place, the stay-at-home order, people were no longer able to safely use. We needed to get into the hands more naloxone to reverse overdoses, because unfortunately there were significant delays with 911 or emergency response services being able to respond to overdoses at the home. I think the other thing too, just when we look at the healthcare system, we had to quickly transition to telemedicine. And that was something that was unheard of in the addiction medicine world, being able to offer telemedicine for substance use services. So unfortunately, the pandemic pretty much ripped this Band-Aid off of our healthcare system and unroofed many, many disparities and inequities that we are dealing with right now. And unfortunately, our Black males have continued to suffer during this time.
So you live and serve patients in a neighborhood where all of this is playing out in a very real way. Tell me about what you're hearing among your patients, what you're seeing on the front lines as a doctor.
A lot of my patients are telling me, you know, in the Black community, the substance of use is pretty much cocaine, a stimulant, and people are inadvertently being exposed to fentanyl, not knowing this. We need to start educating about testing for drugs, and that's something that's unheard of when you know, in the streets, but that's one huge thing that we need to start talking about, because you just don't know what supply you're getting right now.
What about access to treatment and the treatment for those patients once they're in any kind of treatment facility? What about that?
Yeah, that's a huge issue as well, just when you think about access. If we look at the location of treatment centers and where those are located at, now there is a big push to do more on the primary care level, specifically, you know, at my clinic and a few other clinics. But just access, just transportation, getting from one place to another, that's a huge issue. Then you have to think about how many doctors are actually wavered to want to prescribe and practice in this area. So it's another huge issue. And of course, I can't leave out the issues with systemic racism that's inherent and embedded in our healthcare system. So even if you get somebody that show up to care, now we have an issue. If they're feeling like they're not being welcome, they're being stigmatized, they're less likely to come back to you and see you. So we have issues getting people to care and then keeping people in care. It goes back to when we think about the how the laws, the policies, federal policies that were put into place that disproportionately affected our Black and Brown community, the draconian laws, the mandatory sentencing laws. To me, we need to start humanizing this and stop criminalizing this and coming from a perspective of being punitive. So looking at it from that perspective, that we need to start focusing on the people that matter and not being dictated by the laws and policies that are put in place to care for people, because no law or policy should be able to speak for someone's care.
So you are among those leading the charge to stem these soaring death rates. We now have teams going into jails on the ground, into churches. There are mobile van units, Narcan backpacks being handed out, those overdose reversal drugs. Is it enough? Is enough happening on the ground?
You know, I would say I'm definitely appreciative of all those efforts. I think we need to move more towards teaching people how to safely use. Narcan is just one aspect for harm reduction and definitely reversing an overdose. I think that's great. We do know that overdoses occur about 80 to 85% of the time in someone's home. But I think we need to start educating people on how to safely use. And that's something that's uncommon. We don't talk about that, but we need to teach people how to safely use so that you won't die and we can see you again.
That is Dr. Kanika Turner, a physician in St. Louis, Missouri, joining us tonight. Dr. Turner, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Throughout this past month, LGBTQ communities in the U.S. have been celebrating pride in cities and states around the country. Corporate America has made itself a part of that, too, by increasingly tapping into Pride Month and trying to showcase its efforts to increase diversity and inclusion. But there are concerns that Pride has lost some of its political focus, and important issues are not being addressed. Lisa Desjardins has our conversation.
Judy, companies not only celebrate the month, but actively market around it as well. There's a term for that, rainbow capitalism. Walmart and Target have Pride-related ads. IKEA has Pride-themed love seats. And Capital One Bank has this feel-good, splashy video. But for many LGBTQ individuals, it's hardly good times. Several states, including Florida, have passed new restrictions, including on transgender athletes. Hate crimes remain too frequent. Murders of trans individuals are at a new high. It's leading to questions about the purpose of Pride Month. Karen Tongson is an author and professor of gender and sexuality studies at the University of Southern California. Some people might think corporations are using pride symbols more. People are putting rainbow symbols on their Twitter feeds, and they'd think that's support. But why would you say is it a concern?
Well, I think we must understand that it's a gesture of support, but gestures of support, nice words, visible images of solidarity aren't always enough. They're often never enough, actually. And so it's not that people are angry that corporations are, showing some effort at making a gesture to LGBT communities, but it's like, what backs it up? What is there behind that gesture? Is there anything substantial and material that will actually help transform the worlds that we are in and make it better for us?
We're having this conversation, you and I, right now because this is the last day of Pride Month. But what is the trade-off there? We see corporations making a big effort during Pride Month, but does it last all year, or how do you think about that?
Well, there are endless memes and Twitter accounts devoted to corporations in the month of June showing an image of a happy LGBT couple or person, and then corporations on July 1st, which reverts back to exactly the same iconography of straight couples and business as usual. And all we hope is for sustained attention and commitment from these corporations, organizations, and anybody who expresses allyship beyond the month of June into perpetuity on our behalf.
Some corporations that are doing this say we're raising awareness, and in some cases we're raising money. For example, donating some of the sales that they're bringing in from LGBTQ merchandise to causes that are related. I hear you saying you want something substantial. What do you believe that corporate America should be doing?
I think that many of us in the LGBT community are interested in a larger series of systemic changes, policy changes at every level. And, some money towards maybe a popular cause here and there. Sometimes like marriage equality was a kind of mainstream popular cause for a period of time, isn't enough to address the deeper systemic issues that often perpetuate, the oppression of LGBT peoples, especially of color, those who are unhoused, trans people who have violence committed against them, all of the things that actually many Americans are fighting for around systemic equality, the end of white supremacy, etc. And I think LGBT folks see that they're part of a broader movement, that we need to make deeper changes to our system, to our culture, in order to have a more just world.
We're now seeing more visible presence, more attention on different parts of the LGBT community, the transgender community, non-binary individuals, meaning people who don't identify strictly as male or female. Can you talk about the tension and the communications surrounding those groups and how they see this movement?
I think that we have to consider whether or not certain groups who've attained certain privileges within that LGBT acronym have to maybe consider abdicating some of their agenda in order to incorporate what would benefit the most folks under that LGBTQ plus acronym, and whether or not there's true inclusion, acceptance, and understanding for trans, non-binary folks and others in the community, those especially who don't share the same privileges and wealth, so that we can achieve and attain a truly transformative change from our perspective.
Important conversations that we will keep following. Karen Tongson at the University of Southern California, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And a news update before we go. The University of North Carolina Chapel Hill's Board of Trustees has voted to grant tenure to journalist Nicole Hannah Jones, author of the New York Times 1619 Project. She is joining the school's faculty. The board's initial failure to grant her tenure sparked intense criticism. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.